on tonight's Arena. We'll be speaking to Kate McKinnon, star of The Roses. We've a new Marina Carr play to check out, The Boy at the Abbey. And in our film reviews, Caught Stealing, Christie and the Thursday Murder Club. And you can text us this evening, 51551, or email arena@rte.ie, and we're on Instagram at @RTE_arena. But first this evening to another film that you'll catch in cinemas tomorrow, The Roses. Now, it's a remake or reimagining of 1989's The War of the Roses, which was loosely based on the book The War of the Roses, written by Warren Adler in 1981. The original film was directed by Danny DeVito, who also starred in it, alongside Michael Douglas and Kathleen Turner, you may recall, as a warring couple determined to destroy the other by any means necessary. So the 2025 film is directed by Jay Roach, known for films like the Austin Powers series, Bombshell and Meet the Parents. The screenplay is by Tony McNamara, the Oscar-nominated writer of Poor Things and The Favourite. In the film, Olivia Colman and Benedict Cumberbatch star as a dysfunctional married couple, Theo and Ivy, whose picture-perfect life together goes awry when Ivy's career takes off while Theo is fired from his job as an architect. Here is Benedict Cumberbatch at home, minding the kids, while Olivia Colman as Ivy, well, she's having a lovely time.
Oh, God, it's like a plague.
Can you show me when you find some?
Mm.
How do they die?
Well, the conditioner stuns them, and then I take them off the comb, and I break their backs.
That's just awesome.
Hello?
Outside,
because it's your turn to look after the kids and help them with their homework in half an hour.
Not even close. I'm on a jet to LA with David Chang.
We did the photo shoot and he was like, fuck it, let's go to LA and
have dinner with Nancy Silverton.
Right, amazing.
Isn't it? And then...
Just some ham on and more champagne for me, please.
And then in the morning we're going to Malibu to catch fish and grill on the beach. It'll be on my Instagram.
Be sure to look out for it. So you're coming home when? Tomorrow?
Yeah, I know. I should have rung and asked.
Well, that would have been nice.
And then I thought, ask what? For permission? Because we just want to be the couple who love each other and allow each other to grasp the chances life gives us, do we not?
Yes, rhetorical and entrapment. But yes, 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 yes. No, no, of course we do, yeah.
Ty, darling, how was your day?
Well, the neighbour's dog shat in the laundry, the kids have got nits, and my left eye is twitching because I'm so freaking
tired. I've got a head cold.
Sorry, darling, what did you say?
Oh, no, nothing, nothing. You go have fun.
I love you and your big, generous heart.
Love you, kids. Call it better.
Why are you so cross at her?
Because I'm a dick.
It'll end in tears, won't it? Benedict Cumberbatch and Olivia Colman there in a clip from The Roses, which opens in cinemas tomorrow. Now, earlier I spoke to three of the stars of the film. Kate McKinnon stars as Amy, one of the friends of the troubled couple. Kate McKinnon is known for her work on Saturday Night Live. She worked with director Jay Roach previously on Bombshell, and she played, you may recall, Weird Barbie in Greta Gerwig's blockbuster Barbie. Shuti Gatwa plays the head waiter Jeffrey at Ivy's restaurant. Now, Shuti made his screen breakthrough portraying Eric in Sex Education, and he rose to further prominence as the 15th Doctor in Doctor Who. Zoe Chow is best known for her roles in Strangers and The After Party, and here she plays cool, composed Sally, another of the film's mismatched couples.
Kate, Zoe and Shuti, welcome to Arena. Lovely to see you.
Hi, good to see you.
Kate, maybe we'll begin with just the fact that the original of this movie, The War of the Roses, was made in 1989. Tell me about setting it in 2025. Does that really change the dynamic in terms of navigating marriage in this day and age?
I do think it definitely does. I think the gender politics are certainly different. And I think they're navigating things that were not happening in 1989, i.e. The internet and the ability of women to have careers and times have changed and it's brought with it new struggles. And I think that it's just a wonderful update.
Yeah. the three of you feature in this incredible dinner scene that I think screenwriter Tony McNamara had a lot of fun writing. Shuti, maybe you could bring us there in a way, because our two leads and the characters of Theo and Ivy are British. They are surrounded by Americans. And I think this scene really does focus in on those cultural differences and the differences in sense of humour, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And you have, it's just kind of brilliant. The Americans at the table in absolute bemusement as to what is going on. British humour very much paints a very thin line between love and hate anyway. And seeing that come to life in an American context is fun, because we just speak to each other like we hate each other, like all the time, and Americans don't. So it was such a beautiful, what was the word you were saying before? Skewering of cultures that Tony brought into the script seamlessly. And then, yeah, that scene was just performed wonderfully.
Yeah. Zoe, tell us a little more about that. And your character, Sally, within that scene, as Shuti was saying there, our two main characters are bickering and it's really caustic, but the Americans are finding it funny. Tell us about Sally in that scene.
Yeah, well, the one way in which I relate to Sally is that I am an Anglophile. It's embarrassing, but it's true. BritBox. And I do think that we have, as Americans, we tend to put the English on a pedestal of sorts. And so definitely some of that going on with Sally and Rory and how they view Theo and Ivy. Yeah, and she's just so charmed by the rattle bing of it all, you know, because in the U.S. it's our cadence is more like, you know, versus like da da da, you know. Yeah. So I think she wants in on it. She really, which so do I.
Kate, it must have been great fun filming that scene. I'm presuming there was a lot of improv. Was there?
There was. I mean, the scene that appears in the film is largely exactly what Tony wrote in what I'm sure was his first draft. He's just that brilliant. And then we did each take the opportunity to play in a way, and then some of that made it into the cut. But there really was no need. It was just like delish.
Yeah. I mean, Kate, we loved you as Weird Barbie, of course. I think it's fair to say you're weird friend as Amy in this, aren't you?
I am. I'm weird. Noun is what I am in life and on screen. And so, yes.
But she has no filter, right?
She's got no filter. But I think she thinks she's charming and she's great. And she is. She thinks she's really funny. And I've never played a character before who isn't funny and thinks they're funny. I've played characters who are funny but don't know they're funny. I've played characters who are funny. I've never played someone who thinks so highly of herself and is such a shitbird. And so that was really a fun thing.
She's beautifully inappropriate. I suppose, Shuti, you're very much the younger generation within this. As the head waiter in Ivy's restaurant, you've a lovely loyalty, haven't you? Because she's very free with her kids. She wants them to have a great life. There aren't any rules. There are no rules with the staff. What is it about that relationship you two have? You're beautifully loyal with her.
What is it? I think Jeffrey sees how brilliant she is, and also is new to the country and might need, I don't know, a bit of a sharp shot of American capitalism to make the business boost. No, but he also, yeah, he was the first of her staff. And so there is a beautiful loyalty there. I think he sees how brilliant she is. And I guess maybe recognizes that he'll be in a good position to make lots of tips. He likes money. I think that Jeffrey is a Capricorn. And I think, and I think he's willing to like work hard, get that dollar, get that green, and that's him. And Ivy allows him to be all of that. They both allow each other to be their best selves, and that's the
Gosh, you could be
beautiful.
talking about me.
Yeah.
But I also feel like watching the film, Olivia really is that to us too. Like your relationship with, like Olivia's kind of the mom we all want to have, or the sister or your older sister. She's just, you want to do anything and everything for her.
And it's
Yes.
like the brilliance, the precision in a package that is so like, I don't
Yeah.
know. Just
Yeah.
like, it's as if she's not working. She's just,
Well, and if you
it's just coming out of her from nowhere and coming out perfectly.
try to talk to her about work, she'll be like, oh, work, boring. She's like not interested, which I love. And it's just kind of like that with the crabs, right?
Yes, exactly.
It's been lovely talking to you, Kate, Zoe, and Shuti. Thank you so much.
Thank you so
Thank
much.
you.
Thank you.
Kate McKinnon, Shuti Gatwa, and Zoe Chow talking to me earlier, who star in The Roses, which you can catch in cinemas nationwide tomorrow. Well, we'll check out what else you can catch in cinemas this weekend right after this break. You're listening to Thursday Night's Arena, Aideen Gormley with you, and we've four films for review this Thursday. Darren Aronofsky's Caught Stealing arrives as a detour for a director better known for his dramas. Adapted by Charlie Huston from his own novel, the film throws a blue-collar everyman played by Austin Butler into a violent New York underworld of mobsters, crooked cops, and a very memorable cat. More on that anon. Richard Osman's debut novel, The Thursday Murder Club, was a publishing phenomenon, blending gentle comedy with cozy crime. Now Netflix has brought the story to screen with Chris Columbus directing an all-star cast, including our own Pierce Brosnan. Brendan Canty made his name with the breakout Hozier video, Take Me to Church, in 2013, and has been quietly carving out a place as one of Ireland's most promising filmmakers. With Christie, his feature debut, he returns to Cork, now specifically the tight-knit, tough and spirited community of Knocknaheeny, to tell the story of a foster teen whose life teeters between belonging and self-destruction. Belgium has long been a powerhouse of social realist cinema, and with Young Mothers, the Dardenne brothers' 13th feature and Belgium's official submission for the 98th Academy Awards, Jean-Pierre and Luc Dardenne return to their signature style. This time, the focus is on five underage mothers living in a temporary shelter, each struggling with the pressures, trauma and responsibilities of early motherhood. Who has been to the cinema for us this week? Hilary White and Cara O'Doherty are with me in studio. You're both very welcome.
Thank you very much.
Now, let us start with Caught Stealing. And Hilary, you have seen this one from Darren Aronofsky, as I mentioned. This is very different, Darren Aronofsky, isn't it? If we think of the Wrestler and Black Swan, it's a
The Whale,
little bit of
yeah.
The Whale, different little film for him.
It absolutely is, yeah. And it's unlikely to be one that will return him to that critical heyday that he had. This is very much a sort of a 90s Miramax throwback. It's a standalone crime caper. It features a sort of blue-collar protagonist played by Austin Butler, played very well by Austin Butler. And there is that classic scenario where you have a bag of loot and everyone's trying to get their hands on it, and there's a bit of mistaken identity involved, which is why Austin Butler's character is trying to clear his name while all these other people are trying to, sort of murdering each other to get their hands on the loot.
It's very much called a caper, isn't it? Because there's comedy there, but there's violence, there's everything. So it's an ordinary man trying to get away from
Yeah,
trouble.
I mean, it takes us to pre-9/11 New York, so it's very much the realm of Mayor Giuliani, the garage rock revival. The transition from payphones to mobiles hasn't completely taken place
That
just
was
yet.
interesting, wasn't it? Because it's literally 1998 is where he sets
Yeah.
it. And I've seen him say that we have mobile phones, but we're not using them yet to find our way around. So they're just coming in, aren't they?
Absolutely, yeah. And it turns out to be quite an interesting plot device as well. But So Hank, who's played by Austin Butler, he is a baseball player whose career has been cut short by an injury. We don't quite know the full story behind the injury, but it's leaked to us as the film goes on. And he works in a dive bar. His life is otherwise very good. He's got a lovely girlfriend played by Zoe Kravitz. And he has been asked to cat sit for his London punk neighbour, Russ, played by Matt Smith. Again, one of these very much a caricature. This film is laced with caricatures. And he comes back from work one day and he finds these two giant Russian goons kicking in Russ's door looking for Russ. Russ forgot to mention that he's part of a shady deal and there's a bag of loot somewhere and everybody wants to know where Russ is.
Yeah. I think the moral of the tale is don't mind your neighbour's cat is pretty what much, we're going to find out.
Yeah.
We'll come back to the cat in a moment. Let's talk more about Austin Butler. I don't know about you, I thought when he was in Elvis, do you remember when he was doing all the press for it and he still looked like Elvis and he sounded like Elvis? I wondered, was he going to be able to shake that off? He definitely has. You know, Dune 2, Eddington, The Bike Riders, and he really holds his own in this, doesn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. He's very versatile. In this role, he shows great vulnerability, but he's also an anti-hero. He makes some choices that are quite self-serving. Tragedy befalls him and he shakes it off and becomes very laser-focused on what needs to be done. But there's also this backstory, there's a real tragedy to him. And I think he completely nails it. And great physicality is needed for this role too. And he gets that right.
Yeah. It's great to see New York at this time. It reminded me in some ways of, as I say, that ordinary hero out of his depth. There's almost Cary Grant in North by Northwest. Yeah. There's a bit of Hitchcock there, isn't there?
Definitely is. Yeah. Because there is mistaken identity. Everyone thinks that Hank is completely involved in this big score. And so while he's trying to clear his name, he's also trying to get to the root of what exactly is going on here and maybe come out the other side looking a bit better as well.
Yeah. I mean, Darren Aronofsky said he wants people to, you know, go to the cinema to see this. This is what he wants. And maybe there's a little bit of Guy Ritchie, a bit of Tarantino in there too, in the way he's directing this, do you think?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it has this sort of pulverizing score done by the rock band Idols, you know, but it's very sort of hedonistic. It's very fast and loose. And again, there are these caricatures kind of coming out. You're just reminded of that sort of Tarantino heyday or films like 2 Days in the Valley, these kind of great standalone crime capers. And quite cartoonish in places as well. Not afraid to laugh at itself.
So let us talk about The Cat.
The Cat, yeah. An Oscar nomination for The Cat, please. Tonic the Cat, who is, anytime there's a cat in a film, they just have this strange presence, don't they? They just seem to kind of draw in your sight and kind of hold some of the energy and give it off, reverberate it off in a special way.
But he's constantly with Austin because he's minding the cat.
Pretty much. And then the cat comes to signify all these different things to Hank. He is... he's a thing to look after. He is a confidant. He's also like, you know, a prized possession. Don't let anything happen to the cat.
It reminded me, did you remember the cat in Ripley, in the Andrew Scott Ripley? It's that kind of scene-stealing performance from the cat.
Yeah, it's what they do,
the
isn't it?
Did it hold your attention throughout, Hilary?
It did. I mean, it's great fun. It's not too long. Characters are very memorable. Austin Butler is great in it, but it's a little bit throwaway. It's not really something you're going to pore over for days afterwards. It has that kind of slightly disposable standalone feel. But I mean, good fun while you're sitting in front of it.
Okay, how many stars?
3.5.
3.5 out of 5, not bad at all. That is for Caught Stealing. Something completely different now. It's the Thursday Murder Club, and I suppose, Cara, you know, Richard Osman's book, it was hailed for its warmth and its wit, and, you know, we were just waiting for it to hit the big screen. So perhaps, I suppose, firstly, for people who haven't read the book, can you give us a little idea of what this is all about?
Absolutely. And actually, I'm one of those people, I don't know how I haven't read the book, and I realise how rare this is, but I haven't read the book, so I had no frame of reference going into this.
Which is fine, I think.
I think we're
the only two people on Earth.
Two of us in it, so. It is set in Cooper's Chase, which is the most beautiful retirement home you have ever seen. It is essentially a mini version of Downton Abbey. It is where you can only go and live there if you have a lot of money. And the residents in it, it's beautiful. The painting and yoga, everything you want is there. And one group of residents have set up the Thursday Murder Club. And each Thursday, they sit like a group of amateur Agatha Christies poring over real cold case crimes given to them by another resident. And they're focusing on this one particular crime when they hear that there is a bit of an evil landlord contemplating selling their premises. And they get into a bit of a panic about this. And then there's a real life murder. So this group led by Helen Mirren, who is, I won't say exactly what she is, but she's very skilled at interrogation. She knows a lot about crime. She speaks lots of languages. So she kind of heads up this group as they try to solve the real murder in an attempt to save their beautiful retirement home and possibly save the cold case that they were trying to figure out in the Thursday Murder Club as well.
It's all going on. Let's take a clip. Elizabeth, as you say, brilliant Helen Mirren in this, introduces herself to Joyce Celia Imrie and asks her to join the Thursday Murder Club with Ron, played by Pierce Brosnan, and Ibrahim, Ben Kingsley.
Are you a nurse?
Sorry, what?
It's just that you didn't flinch at those photos earlier on, so I think that maybe you have some sort of medical training. Of course, you could have been a doctor, but female doctors were very rare when we were young, so I'm thinking a trauma nurse, seen a lot of fatal injuries. Am I close?
Bang on target.
I'm sorry, I'm Elizabeth.
Ibrahim. Mm-hmm. Ron.
I'm Joyce.
Joyce.
So, Joyce, would you take a look at that for me, please?
Dear God. Perhaps we could leave the finer details for later.
Could that girl have survived an injury like that?
Well, that would depend partly on how much she weighed. It is a lot of blood.
46 kilos.
Yes, then I think she could have survived, providing she had...
Look, how long is all this kerfuffle going to last? We're doing the extra hard Sudoku here.
Joyce, would you care to join us to discuss things further? Privately.
Oh, all right. But who is us?
I'm sorry, how rude of me. We're the Thursday Murder Club.
The Thursday Murder Club. Quite a cast, Hilary. And, I mean, Chris Columbus directing. It should all work, shouldn't it?
Yeah, an embarrassment of riches, you would definitely say about this. I mean, to be able to say Helen Mirren, Pierce Brosnan, and Ben Kingsley in your cast. Richard E. Grant even pops up as well. And Chris Columbus, who, you know, is you know, Mr. Entertainment, someone who's synonymous with a good night out. And then you have this mega-selling book. It should work, but you're sort of wondering, why is this not working? Why is none of this coming together? Why is it so insipid, so anodyne? Why aren't the jokes landing? Why are they just piling murder on top of murder without kind of, you know, leaving one to be resolved or to have them fitting together in like a something that's coherent? This is very disappointing. And also, I think just the world that we're in, we're very much in a sort of theme park depiction of England, very biscuit tinny, almost to England what something like Leap Year was to Ireland, just very theme parky, designed for, you know, people the other side of the Atlantic who maybe don't have passports, who knows. And yeah, it was a real letdown, this.
That's harsh from Hilary. Did you agree, Cara?
Definitely not as harshly so. So I do think, like, it is overly long at 2 hours. We don't need 2 hours of this. It is quite Hallmarky in that depiction, but it is quite jolly. It's light, it's breezy. And to a certain extent, it is a sweet kind of nice escape, but it does get bogged down in that final act. It just goes crazy. There's all sorts of, there's Polish gangsters and weird things. You're like, where are these extra things coming from? So it definitely loses the run of itself. But there are some fun moments as well. And I mean, there's Celia Imrie's character is the most amazing baker. And I was quite happy just watching people eat her amazing cakes. So I think it's a nice little escape. It could have been a much stronger thing. And with that cast, as Hilary said, Helen Mirren is brilliant, but they could have done so much more. So it's definitely a nice little escape. But by the end of it, you're like, can you just either murder the rest of them or wrap this up, please?
I suppose it's interesting as well, the two of you haven't read it, so you didn't know the whodunit part of it. People who will have read it, I wonder, you know, they'll know the end, so it might be a very different experience.
Possibly. I just thought it rushed in very much at the start. It just kind of galloped straight into it. There's no effort made to kind of establish the characters.
No, it's very much, there's a dead person.
Yeah,
there's
just,
a body.
You know, oh, try look, and keep up. Oh, you haven't read the book? Well, we don't really care. You know?
Yeah, so.
And it's funny, you mentioned cake there. Cake does play a pretty prominent part in this film, and I am quite a big fan of cake, it must be said. But I felt this was a little bit like eating too much cake, and cake that had very much been over-iced.
Okay. Yeah. There's a little bit of sentimentality there and a little bit of humour. How do you think they managed that in terms of, say, Helen Mirren's husband, for example?
That is, that's lovely. So her husband is played by Jonathan Pryce and he has a form of dementia. And there's a very lovely relationship there between them. His memories come and go, but the love is still very strong. And that's really nicely depicted. And Celia Imrie's character, she has lost her husband. So she's mourning him and trying to find a new way of being and existing without him, and through this group of people she's starting to move on from her grief. So there's these lovely little pockets, but again they're just not fully fleshed out. Even Pierce Brosnan's character, his son Jason is involved in it. He's played by Tom Ellis, and they have a lovely relationship because he's a son who actually visits his father in the retirement home, and then his character may possibly be involved in things, which just adds an extra complication to it. But there's lovely little pockets in there. They just get lost in the kind of over schmaltzy view of retirement life. But at the same time, I mean, I wouldn't mind if retirement looked like that. I'd be quite happy.
As you said, it's cross between maybe Downton and Hogwarts. It's a lovely place to hang out.
I'd go there.
Pierce Brosnan plays a former trade union leader. I'm just wondering what all his trade union buddies are thinking of him in this lavish, retirement home with servants and
living. Well, I suppose his son's a boxer, so we can assume he was paying for his new home. He's waving his trade union flag in it, so he hasn't given up there.
And not, I mean, he's the busiest actor in town at the moment. Not doing the Irish accent in this one, Hilary.
Quite a wobbly Cockney accent in
this, but it was a relief, actually, to not be an Irish accent. I can take the wobbly Cockney. Yeah. That's fine.
Irish actors who can't do Irish accents is becoming a strange phenomenon. You mentioned the Jonathan Pryce character. Yeah. I thought that was one of the sort of almost redeeming factors in it. It's a lovely performance by Pryce, and it is quite a nice sort of interlude from the scariness. It felt like, in a way, one of the most developed characters in the entire thing, this sort of side character who was in a room stuck playing chess.
Is it going to be the same kind of audience for sort of the Best Exotic Marigold Hotel? Is that what we're looking at?
I was thinking more something like Only Murders in the Building. It just has that very kind of like overproduced sheen about it. A bunch of older people trying to relive the sort of their younger, more adventurous selves in, you know, solving crimes that, you know, they're not that flustered about, they're not that traumatized by. I thought more something like that, and I thought that's really what Chris Columbus was trying to mine with a film like this. But I think in doing so, he lost any sense of place, any sense of atmosphere, and something that just, it's too glossy, it's too...
Okay. And Cara, I mean, this is a Netflix release. Would it have done well in cinemas, do you think?
I think the fact that the book was so big, people would have gone out to see this without doubt.
Yeah.
And I think people will still want to watch it. So they've lost a trick by not releasing it. It would have done nicely for itself, regardless of what we're here to say. And I think it's still, I mean, people will watch this. By the end of the week, it will be in Netflix's top 10.
It will. It's a cozy watch of a Sunday evening. And I mean, I'm looking at the number of books that were sold, 15 million copies translated into 46 languages. I mean, I think we might see them back. What do you think, Hilary?
I think let's watch this space. Okay. Let's see how we go.
Let's take stars from you, Cara.
Three stars.
And from you, Hilary?
Two for me, I'm afraid. Yeah.
Three and two for the Thursday Murder Club. That is on Netflix at the moment if you fancy a cosy night in. We have two more movies to check out. You're listening to Arena, Thursday night's Arena. Aideen Gormley here with you, and still with me in studio, Cara O'Doherty and Hilary White. We've already reviewed Caught Stealing and the Thursday Murder Club. And of Irish interest now, Christie, the debut feature from Brendan Canty. Hilary, this is expanded as a short, isn't that right?
That's right. It was a short that himself and his screenwriter, Alan O'Gorman, they came out with this in 2019, and they obviously saw that there was more to kind of explore with this. What they put together is very much in the tradition of social realism. We're taken to the North Cork suburb of Knocknaheeny, slightly down and out, but a very, very tight-knit community. And we are given a character who is a 17-year-old, the titular Christie, played quite incredibly by Danny Power, and he is at risk of falling through the cracks of the foster system. So when we meet him, he has been in a scuffle, is being turfed out of his foster home, and his half-brother, who has a job, has his own business, he's a painter-decorator, has a new baby in the home, has to pick him up and take him in while a new home is found for him. And in the meantime, there he becomes sort of accepted and taken in by the wider community. The other kids who were playing in the cul-de-sacs there in Knocknaheeny, and I think, you know, a glimmer of a future is shown to him, you know, a better life. But at the same time, there is this foster system, and there's sort of a quiet debate happening. Is he better off sticking with that system, or is he better off staying with the brother?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. And, you know, when he comes back into this community, a lot of people remember him and he doesn't really know them. You mentioned they're the young people he meets. Let's hear them all in this clip.
Come on, boys. Fuck, we're late in 2 weeks and we've collected fuck all. Get up off your arse, you lazy prick.
Shut your mouth.
Who's going to shut up for me? You?
Yeah, I will. Yeah?
Leona, get off the phone and help us.
Go away, you mug.
Jordan broke up with you, so I don't know who you're talking to.
Here, there's a hand there, will you?
Are you robbing shit?
No, we're collecting for Bonnie Knight, you clown.
Just lift that pallet out for us.
I nearly have it out, Wedge. Come on.
How? Can I have the end of your fag?
Oh, can ya? Come on, what did I tell you about smoking? You have to give that shit up, man.
Lads, would you leave him alone?
See you later.
You're Shane's brother, aren't you?
I am, yeah.
Yeah, I heard you were staying with him. I'm the one that means Charlie. Are you on Facebook?
Yeah.
Add me there, Shirley. You want a Hagerty?
Ah, look at you. They turned your crack on Dame already. You're well, though.
Would you go away with your pallety babies?
Good luck at the ride, Leona.
No, shut up, boy. That's my sister.
Ignore them. They're actually gormies.
gives us a good idea of Christy. And it's interesting, Cara, the way Hilary described it there. It sounds like a very sad tale for Christy, but it is the community, and in particular those young actors that lift it and bring that humour in.
Anyway, this really could have been a very, very sad story, and it's not without its serious elements. But this community is so vibrant, it is so supportive, and it's so funny. I mean, it really captures that north side of Cork and that sense of humour. They're bold, they're smart, they're sparky. And the lovely thing is that it is an area that, you know, it has its difficulties, but it doesn't stop anybody from having pride in their community and really coming together. And for Shane, for Shane, the older brother, yeah. He could come across as quite a cold character because he's uncertain about having his younger brother in his house. But he lived in the foster system and he has this life together now. And he's so afraid of his world being unbalanced that he is a little bit nervous about having Christy there. And Christy can't quite understand it. He was young. He doesn't remember exactly what happened when they were children. So Christy starts to find the support network through the kids in the area. They, as Hilary said, they remember him. And bit by bit, he sort of forms this bond. And it's sort of through them that he also gets to see his brother in a different light through Chris Wally's character, who works with his brother. And it's this really beautiful way of coming together through adversity, but really that strength and community. And it really is that thing that it does at times take a village to raise a child, and in this case, to raise a community of kids who were steadfast in their support of each other. And it's that sense of humour that keeps them all going no matter what. And particularly the young lad we heard there quite a good bit, Jamie Ford, who he is an absolute scene stealer. Yeah. That child is destined for great things.
He's a film in itself. Robot is the character that plays.
Because I just thought that the balancing act that was here between the sentimentality and the humour, the lightness, the darkness. And as you said as well, Hilary, about Danny Power, the camera in his face, it's an extraordinary performance, isn't it?
It's such a quiet
performance in many ways.
It is, yeah. And he communicates a lot without moving his mouth, which is always a great hallmark of an actor. And he's got a haunted expression in this. And as Cara was saying, you know, it could be a very dour film. This is, you know, the haunted expression, the wet asphalt, you know, the rundown part of Cork. It could really bring it down. But there's such sheer colour and vividness from these amazing children that live in this community, and just the Norrie slang that you're hearing, these amazing words like langball and smellbag as they all tease each other.
It's completely Cork.
It is. I mean, it's very salty and it's very rapid fire, but there's something very good natured about it.
And we have to stay for the credits, right?
Oh, absolutely. You do have to say
very important.
Yeah, any cabin crew fans will definitely want to head along to this.
It's a fine debut. All right, let me get stars from you, Hilary.
A 4 from me.
4 and yourself?
Oh, absolutely a 4. It is such a strong, strong film. And I just add a bonus point that Dermot Noyes is not from Cork, and who plays Shane, and his accent is impeccable. That's a hard.
It's okay to not be from Cork.
It is. I know. Well, yeah. Now, don't be saying that on air.
Strong but, views for Christy. That is in cinemas at the moment. And you say a very fine cast. A final movie to mention tonight. And Hilary, you have seen this one. Mm. Young Mothers from Belgian brothers Jean-Pierre and Luc Dardenne. This is quite an emotional affair. It's interesting, isn't it, coming after Christy? We're talking about Young Mothers now.
Absolutely, because they're both jumping at the same thing from opposite ends of that equation. And this is about four very young mothers who are in a temporary home. They're underprivileged, they're disadvantaged, and each of them is grappling with one of the problems or challenges in the sort of broad church of motherhood. So one of them is a recovering addict, one of them was adopted themselves and came through the foster system, one of them is trying to, you know, sort of naively keep her man by her side and so that he'll settle down with her. And it's the Dardenne brothers. I mean, they are, I would argue, very much cornerstones of this great sort of wellspring of social realist drama that has come through Europe. And they've been making films like this for many decades at this stage. This has just been announced as Belgium's official submission for the Oscars.
Does it stand a chance?
I think it possibly would. I'm not sure how much the Academy go for these kind of films. Mm. But then again, Lucas Daunt, another social realist Belgian, he had a nomination in 2022, I believe, with Close. So maybe there's a chance for a
this
nomination.
This is, I suppose, as you say, in that style, the more docudrama.
Definitely is, yeah. It's handheld cameras. It's hovering on the shoulders, and it's very naturalistic style acting. You know, it's
quite moving, I think, too.
It's very moving. Yeah. It's so moving because the characters are just so vividly rendered. You can almost reach out and touch them, and their stories are depicted in a way that's almost like you're looking at them through a pane of glass. You know, it's quite incredible. And there's some absolute powerhouse performances. Lucie Larouelle playing Perla, I just thought was a revelation, and I think she's a very interesting career ahead of her. I thought this was a real knockout of a film. Okay. This is the full 5 stars from
the
me.
Full 5 stars?
Full 5. It's one of the best things I've seen this year.
Wow. Yeah. High praise indeed. Thank you so much, Hilary White and Cara Doherty, for joining us in studio. Our films tonight, The Roses, Caught Stealing, and Christie are on general release. The Thursday Murder Club is now on Netflix, and Young Mothers is on limited release. You're listening to Thursday Night's Arena with Aideen Gormley. Now, a new play by Marina Carr is always something of an occasion. But her next work, The Boy, more than deserves its subtitle, a two-play theatrical event. The double bill is, in fact, Marina's version of three of the most famous Greek tragedies of all time, beginning with Oedipus Rex and ending with Antigone. They are known as the Theban Trilogy and were written by Sophocles. The plays are The Boy and The God and His Daughter, and they open next month at the Abbey Theatre as part of the Dublin Theatre Festival. Director Katrina McLaughlin has put together an impressive cast. Among them, Eileen Walsh plays Jocasta, wife and mother of Oedipus. Alwyn Fuere is the She, and Jolly Abraham is God Woman. I'm delighted that all three join me in studio. You're all very welcome. Eileen, I suppose after what I've just said there, I must come straight to your character, Jocasta, wife and mother of Oedipus. Can you tell us more about the character and, I suppose, why Oedipus is cursed?
Well, so I am married very young, and my husband takes a young boy, and the gods see this as being a crime, and therefore he is punished and says, if you ever have a child of your own, that child will kill you and marry its mother. And so to prevent that from happening, he steals our firstborn and kills him, as far as he's concerned. So he's beaten the gods as far as he's concerned. However, that little boy is saved and grows up elsewhere, and accidentally on a road one night kills his father, and then turns up as the hero in my town, and I fall desperately in love with him, which happens.
Wow. So, you know. What a character Marina has given you.
Marina has given us this gift of an incredible journey for all of us within it. It's like a Netflix series, really, in one day. It's really incredible, eating and drinking in it.
Alwyn, you've been in so many Marina Carr's of her plays, early works like Ulalo, also at the Abbey. The Greeks run through from the beginning. Can you tell us, you know, what do you get when you bring the ancient Greeks together with a Marina Carr play? What happens here?
Well, I think the ancient Greeks are in all Marina's work. Fundamentally, that's the territory that she seems to live in, however, usually within a contemporary context. So so you come across it all the time. It's like By the Bog of Cats is Medea, basically. You can probably, and Medea would never be mentioned in By the Bog of Cats. In this case, the names of the original Greek mythological characters are in there, but it's still, the whole piece is still within a contemporary world. And it has to be. And if ever we find it slipping away to some kind of more classical world, it's very, very quickly brings itself back to here and now, where we are in the world.
Jolly, you play grey-eyed god woman, daughter of Zeus, also described as the flashing-eyed. So this is a pretty big character, right?
I mean, you know, she's subtle. So, yeah, she is. She's, I believe Marina kind of took inspiration from the goddess Athena. Athena in Greek mythology is known as the gray-eyed godwoman, I believe, or gray-eyed goddess. But yeah, she's kind of made her own thing with godwoman, you know, and I love the fact that she adds woman onto it, which I think is very telling for why Marina does it for the first play. And because in the second play, the gods are kind of not present as much, which it's very interesting that she does that.
So are you then very much in charge of both the She and Jocasta?
I am in charge of everything.
Everything,
yes. Okay. Yeah, she is on the pinnacle, I would say, for the hierarchy of the gods. And it is her wrath that everyone feels.
Yeah.
Eileen, I loved how Marina Carr gives the directions for the start of the text here, setting a fluid space, time, always.
Yes.
Where do you think you are?
So I think you can never be ready for a Marina play. Marina's plays are here and they're us and they're our living rooms, but they're these epic stories that get told, you know, down on the farm. And so she opens up opportunities by actually not fencing off anything. You know, there's another direction where she says 100 babies and one speaks. Yes. So you're like, oh my God, how are they going to do that? But like, she just gives you opportunities, you know?
Alwyn, we might stay with that opening scene. The boy opens with yourself as the She having dinner with Oedipus and Jocasta. You know, I often think we mention first lines of novels when novels are really good. But look at again what Marina gives us here. Oedipus's first line: there's only us and the stories we can spin. Believing in God is like believing in money. Fiction, all fiction. What a start. Tell us where you go to from there and what the tone is.
I love that first scene.
Yeah.
It's actually the scene that exists in and around the play. In some sense, they've lived it all, but they're in this sort of purgatorial space where they're tapping into it again and giving the audience a sense of the massive history behind us as humans, really. I know it's a fantastic opening piece. And I think the idea is as well, it's going to be repeated for the beginning of the second play because it has this sort of cyclical suggestion of this sort of cyclical nature that we continue, we live through these things and we then repeat them again. And that's a very big Marina theme, is that we repeat and we repeat.
Yeah. And it is amazing as well how many of us quote lines from the play going, oh, I love that one, I love that one. Like Frank Blake, who plays Oedipus, Frank has, no one gets to the exit without all the edges cut off.
Wow.
And it's just beautiful.
Yeah.
And
Jane Brennan, yeah.
Jane Brennan, who plays Queen of the Furies, she's so amazing in it. But forever kind of coming off going, oh my God, what about that one? What about that one? Like, it's incredible.
Yeah.
And just to come back to the She, in terms of what your role is in society, how is it that, you know, you have such power over the king, if you like? You can talk to him quite openly.
Well, there is where the sort of the classical world and this world need to meet. And the oracle in ancient Greece and in Sophocles' time had immense political influence and spiritual power. So most leaders would not do anything, would not go into battle with, they would consult with her about everything. So in some ways, you could look at it as being the equivalent of when the church and state were united in Ireland. But we are also at a point where they are starting to, and the first play very much goes into that, they're starting to distrust the gods or not believe in the gods. And Jocasta very much doesn't believe in the power of the gods. But of course, when you come around to the second play, basically you understand that he totally fulfills the prophecy by trying to avoid it.
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of darkness here, but Jolly, I wanted to talk about the humour. Some of the humour for me came just with the Irish lilt of the language within this, you know. But also, I mean, I'm thinking of one of the lines when you ask the she, are you the best they could come up with? Again, the statue just fed up, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yes. What do you feel about the humour in it?
For me, the more humor in any play kind of is a great sort of juxtaposition to any of the drama. Like, you need both, in my opinion.
Yeah.
So I tend to try and lean into any sort of comedy. And I think for just the God woman scenes, the bit that is in there, it adds a sort of human personification of the God. Mm-hmm. Which I think is helpful to kind of be relatable. She's just really annoyed at the she.
And the power
please
structure.
Please take care of this. Yeah. Why are you not doing this?
The power structure is very like, you know, I think the she similarly thinks, God woman, it's just now I have to do all the work.
I know. And the she is annoying.
So
it's
her fault that my baby was taken and killed in my head. That's what we all believe. So I have no faith in any gods.
And Jolly, what do you as good woman make of the mortals, these clodhoppers, as you call them?
They're really ungrateful people. They're ungrateful little minions. Yeah. And that is essentially, I think there is a love that God woman has for the mortals. Otherwise, she wouldn't have created them. And I mean, I think that's what really gets her. I mean, she has a line, I took you out and I brought you out of muck and I gave you the wing bones of the first angels. And this is how you thank me, by not seeing the beauty you have in you every day around you. And that's kind of, you know, in a way, that's every day in our own lives. Like, we don't appreciate what we see and what we actually have. And that, for me, is what's important in that scene, in a way, is to kind of get that across as interestingly as possible.
Is there an incredible, I mean, I'm feeling it off the three of you already, this kind of female energy with, you know, such strong actors in this, with Marina Carr, female director as well. Is that what's happening in the rehearsal room at the moment? Are you feeling
that? Yeah, incredible design team as well, like very heavily female. Yeah. I mean, it does feel, I think anything, you know, that Marina tells is very potent. But it is a very female-centric room. Mm-hmm. It's just that then when the boys bring the power, that becomes so self-centered and so justified in their ego and power. It's quite fantastic how then the women have to kind of pull it back.
And how is that sitting, do you think, in 2025, that male ego and the God complex? How is
it
sitting?
It's everywhere right now. I mean, you know, we only have to look to America to begin with. But, you know, the rise of the far right, which is led, well, mind you, there's Giorgia Meloni in Italy, but it is very much associated with that sort of, the leader is beginning to believe that they are a match for the gods.
Yes. Mm. Yeah.
To come back, Eileen, to the darkness and the incest as such, there is that very unnerving point when Jocasta and Oedipus pretty much say, well, yes, we did know about the relationship, right? It's shocking, isn't it? How do you feel about it?
Well, I love it, obviously. But I'm also aware of it's like boy mums. I have two girls. But whenever I see boy mums, you know, they adore their sons, and which is brilliant. But it is just taking it a little step further. And, you know, when they meet, they don't know. It's just that something is familiar.
that smell, that knowledge of each other. And like, actually, it's just really sexy. Mm-hmm. Because they are wanton in their lust for each other, you know. And yeah, they don't have, you know, the kind of shame around it. They are just devouring each other in it. And I think it's later that they kind of go, actually, given the knowledge, you can piece together, that was familiar, that was familiar. Maybe yeah. I did know. Did I know, and did I choose to ignore it? Mm. You know?
It's very beautiful. To me, the whole piece is a absolutely beautiful, passionate love story.
It's a love story almost. Yeah, for you, okay. I always think with a new play, it must be interesting to originate a role. I mean, Jolly, even I'm thinking of you. You've played, say, Valerie in The Weir again in the Abbey. But, you know, we will talk about this production. Well, do you remember what Eileen did? Do you remember what Almond did? Do you remember what Jolly did? You've nobody to play off this time. You are starting it off. Is that, I want to ask the three of you, is it challenging or is it refreshing?
Yeah, I think every play is, because every time you come to a play, whether it's Chekhov or whatever, you know, it's the first time I've done it. And what's different? What do I bring that's different to Alwyn playing it or Jolly playing it? Or, you know what I mean? So it's actually very enthusiastic to get to find your corners in it and your stamp on it.
Yeah.
But there's nothing more pleasing than opening the, you know, a copy of the play and seeing original cast.
Yeah.
That's quite a thrill for an actor.
How does that feel, Jolly? You're going to be the first woman to play this role.
Yeah. Great. It's happened a couple of times, and it is. It's just because you feel kind of a part of a larger community of artistry making, you know, not just trying to make a job as an actor. You feel like part of a movement of the theater experiences, you know, and that's what's really special. And yeah, with Godwoman, I think I mentioned she can really go so many ways. So this is just my own like sort of wonky thoughts and ideas. Mm. And I've been, you know, grateful and thankful enough to Katrina and Marina for letting me play. And that's really all it, you know.
And Alwyn, this role for you, you know Marina Carr so well, you know the language so well. How's this one been?
This one has been, it's interesting because like it's not a taxing role. It's not a big part at all, but it's challenging in its kind of creation because of trying to tie together all those elements of the ancient Greeks and here, and to make the she into a person who of that kind of importance, that it makes sense that they would believe in her or not believe in her. So that's been a very difficult thing to try and align, you know. Mm. So more and more, she's becoming like the still point of a turning world, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say, she is so omnipresent that you might feel like she's not a big part. She is all over it. She's like, every time you turn around, the she is there.
She just creeps in.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit of your experience of, you know, the page now to the stage. I'm intrigued as to how it's going to look. Have you seen sets, costumes at this point?
Yes. Yeah, the sets is fantastic. The costumes has been like a big collaboration because Catherine Faye is such a brilliant collaborator. So that's all coming together.
Yeah, it's really beautiful. It's really beautiful. And we get into the theatre next week. So it'll be lovely to bring that to play on the stage itself, to get to experience what the set is, because it looks monumental.
Yeah.
You know, so it'll be beautiful to get to kind of bring our performances to something that's kind of ready to deliver this epic story.
So just for those listening as part of the Dublin Theatre Festival, this feels to me very Dublin Theatre Festival because you can do a full day, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So and you should do a full day. Yes. We're all fighting for everybody to only see two. They can't see one.
Yes. Yeah. You can see one play a day, or you can see two on the Wednesdays or the Saturdays, and that's abbeytheatre.ie. Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah. Don't see one without the other, is all we're saying.
You get to know everybody around you when you come back after the break.
I love that.
That's great, isn't it?
Yeah.
But it's a fantastic ensemble piece. I mean, that's the great joy of working on this piece as well. Like, it's a big cast, and it's such a great group of people. And that room
the music,
is like, we're all watching scenes just going, oh my God.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. You've whetted our appetites. Thanks so much after rehearsals for coming in to see us this evening. Eileen Walsh, Almaen Frary and Jolly Abraham. You can see The Boy, a two-play theatrical event by Marina Carr at the Abbey Theatre from the 15th of September to the 1st of November as part of the Dublin Theatre Festival. Further details from abbeytheatre.ie. Shana Will, that's it for tonight's Arena. Aideen Gormley signing off. Thanks to the team, producer Shana O'Gorman, researcher Paula Shields, broadcast coordinator Ollie Hamilton and on sound Paul Murnock. Ciara King will be here tomorrow evening at 6:30. You'll find me back on the Lyric FM airwaves tomorrow at 1 p.m. So enjoy your evening and stay tuned. Great music ahead with John Creedon.